Okay, so hi everyone. We're Epiphany and we want to give you a brief introduction of our program here. We're sponsored by the San Diego State University's Counseling and Psychological Services. We are a student-driven, student-led, student-centered workshop program that is created as a space to explore Asian American Pacific Islander, ethnic identity, and mental health. Since 2018, we've also adapted a social justice focus where participants can learn more about history, identity, and other sociocultural issues affecting the AAPI community in America today. Also, we pride ourselves a space for empowerment, elevation, restoration, and healing. So we're going to go around and introduce our team a bit. My name's Ingrid, and I'm a third-year psychology student here at SDSU, and I'm an intern at S Epiphany. So I'm going to pass this along for Yumi to introduce herself.
Hi everyone, my name is Yumi. I'm also a third year mechanical engineering student, and I'm also an intern with Epiphany. Hi everyone, so happy to have you here. This is Dr. Koko Nishi. My pronouns are she, her, hers. I'm very, very excited for y'all to join us today for our very special podcast episode. I currently work at Counseling and Psychological Services as a licensed clinical psychologist and also the co-advisor of the Epiphany Workshop Series. And I'm going to pass it over to my other co-advisor.
Hi everyone, my name is Jessica Chang. My pronouns are she, her, hers, and I work at SDSU as a diversity officer for student engagement at the Center for Inclusive Excellence and honored to be co-advisor to Epiphany as well. I'm so excited to be able to have our guest today in our podcast, and I will go ahead and pass it off to her. Munju, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, thanks so much, Jessica, and thank you all at Epiphany. My name is Manju Kulkarni. I am she, her, hers. I'm the executive director of AAPI Equity Alliance and one of the co-founders of Stop AAPI Hate. A real honor and privilege to be with you all.
Yay! Thank you so much again. We had such a great event with Trin Lee, who is representing Stop AAPI Hate on campus, our on-campus program. And now we're excited to continue our conversation and be able to talk to you, Munju, about how Stop AAPI was founded, what y'all are doing now, and what's upcoming for you. So I'll go ahead and go into our first question. For you, could you please tell listeners about the process of co-founding Stop AAPI Hate? And feel free to share like your story as I know that's just so important and part of kind of in conjunction with social justice or the work that we do. So we'd like to hear about that.
Sure. Thanks so much, Jessica, for that question. So a little background, AAPI Equity Alliance is a coalition of over 40 community-based organizations that together serve and represent the 1.6 million Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders in Los Angeles. We've been around since 1975. Of course, I was a small child then, so I've only been with the organization since 2017. But that really, I think, creates sort of the backdrop or foundation for not only, Stop AAPI Hate, but all the work that we do, which is for all our populations in the AA and PI communities. And it includes issues like human trafficking, mental health, healthcare access, environmental justice, housing and economic development. These are just a few. And so it was in the spring of 2020, and actually the winter even, when before there was a single confirmed case of COVID-19 in Southern California, we were informed about something that was so tragic that happened to a child in middle school at a local public school in Los Angeles. He was on the school yard during recess, and another child approached him and said, "Hey, you're a COVID carrier, go back to China." And reflexively, he just responded and said, I'm not Chinese. It was not any, you know, effort to distance himself, but he couldn't go back if he was not from China, right? And so he said that. And then the other child punched him in the face and head 20 times. And so it was really because of that harrowing case that we got started in this work. You know, I mentioned that this took place in February. Not one case of COVID-19 in Los Angeles or surrounding areas. And what that tells us is that sadly, racism preceded even the spread of the virus itself. So another child had heard about COVID, maybe even made that connection to China. And then it was literally just by association that he saw a child he thought looked Chinese to him and, you know, took that reprehensible action. So we immediately began working with the family, ensuring that their needs were met. And then we held a press conference at API Equity Alliance. Back then we were known as APCON, Asian Pacific Policy and Planning Council. And our local leaders stood with us and said, this would not be tolerated in LA. This is not the kind of city, not the kind of county that we are. We actually got coverage, news coverage across the country. And so some folks that now I work with every single day reached out to me. I got a cold call from Russell Jung to say, we're seeing the same things in the Bay Area. I had actually known Cynthia Che from our work on gender-based violence together in LA in the early 2000s. And so we said, you know, we want to know and understand more of what's happening. So without any real media attention, we just launched what really initially was a Google form. And it just asked questions, you know, what have you experienced? Where, when, how? And within just a couple of weeks, we got several hundred incident reports from all across the country. And that now is over 11,000. We've now built a team to help address what's happening through policy and advocacy, data and research, narrative change, as well as capacity building.
Wow, that is incredible. And I wasn't aware of this, the backstory that you shared about the young child in the school, and to hear incidents like that happening and not go reported is just heartbreaking. And so it's so incredible that you all have the insight to create something like this to give folks, you know, space to report. And I just had a quick follow-up question for you, Ranju, in terms of if people are, you know, wanting to report something. I think, especially within the API community, we tend to be more hesitant and more scared to kind of reach out. Could you give some insight to our listeners of like what that would look like if they did want to report through the website? What can they expect?
Sure. So we certainly encourage folks to report to Stop AAPI Hate. We are the nation's leading aggregator of anti-Asian hate incidents. And what we do with the information is we have the reporting center. Some folks also are interested in providing a full intake, which is an interview with one of our staff who actually has an MSW. And so he is really thoughtful in asking questions. And what we've heard from folks is this is often cathartic for them. It helps in the healing process. And what we do with the information is analyze it, and it helps us to understand what's going on, what's happening to our community members and what the impacts are. Now, I will say that we do not have resources adequate to actually address what's going on for each and every individual that reports to us. So certainly if it is something that's life-threatening or can cause injury, we encourage folks to call 911, right, as it's happening. And there also are a number of resources in local communities and in the state of California. I know in Los Angeles, we have a program called LA versus Hate, and you can get mental health resources and services. You can get other types of help. And this is as it should be, which is that our governments and public institutions really should be the ones providing help to our communities, right? That's why they're there. There's also now a program called California versus Hate, and they do something similar across the whole state of California. So I do want to just, you know, explain to folks the differences, you know, when you need additional resources and services, please reach out to our public institutions. But I think part of what we are trying to do is to understand and then help in following up with policy and advocacy, as well as other types of resources across all of our communities.
Thank you. So moving on to the next question. For people listening, as listeners, how could we help battle the API discrimination that happens in day-to-day life?
Thanks so much, Yumi, for that question. So what's critical here is, first off, raising awareness, right? So folks know and understand what's happening. And it's not simply in our communities, but really across all communities, right? For us to know and understand really what white supremacy looks like. And unfortunately, we continue to battle that, not just as Asian Americans and Pacific Islanders, but African Americans, Latinx, and Indigenous communities. And so awareness is the first step to taking action. And so what we do, you know, with our data, as I mentioned, it is that policy and advocacy piece. And what listeners can do, A, is report to Stop API Hate. Two is to share their stories if they feel comfortable, you know, with family, with friends, obviously to get support, but also so others know what's going on. And then together we can address it through policy and advocacy. And that's really social change, right? We want to make sure that we address what's going on and that we prevent it. And so part of what I would love to have people in our community do is to engage in policy and to engage in advocacy. We are seeing right now ways in which rhetoric are resulting in policies that are really detrimental for our communities. And I'll give you a short history lesson because I also do teach it in Asian American Studies at UCLA. So that's my second hat. But you know, in the 1920s, we saw something very similar, which was a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment. We saw the real beginnings of the yellow peril and even the dusky peril. And I put those in quotes. So yellow peril targeted at East Asians, the dusky peril at folks like me, South Asians, who I guess are thought to be dusky because of our brown complexion. But what was happening in California and 13 other states is people were weaponizing our race and immigration status to say immigrants shouldn't own land. And so millions of dollars of property was really stolen just under our feet. And that's true for Latinx communities as well. And not only was it stolen, but folks could not then buy land or property, right? This was farms, this was homes. And that's what you're seeing right now. The state of Florida has passed a law that prevents Chinese immigrants from purchasing property. Can you believe that? My own parents were immigrants. I was an immigrant as a child until I became a U.S. citizen in my teens. And so to imagine that they couldn't have bought their first or second house, enabled us to live in a safe neighborhood, you know, go to good public schools. That's what's happening to Chinese nationals in Florida right now. And real estate agents can be arrested for selling a home to Chinese individuals. 33 other states are doing the same thing. And Louisiana has a proposal that Chinese immigrants cannot even rent property. So imagine all of the students at LSU, at Xavier, at Tulane, who wouldn't be able to even rent an apartment while they're studying. So this is really, really concerning for us. And, you know, we haven't learned the lessons of history. So I encourage listeners, get involved. It is so important that we prevent actions like this from happening, that we stand up to rhetoric. We know that rhetoric from politicians often leads to attacks. And in fact, we saw that 20% of the hate that our community experienced was because of the rhetoric from 2020 in that election cycle. We are back at that just months from now. And so we need each and every person in our community to speak out, to say it's wrong, and really hold our electeds accountable for what they say and what they do.
Thank you so much, Manju. I can really sympathize with the whole situation, and I love hearing how passionate you are about this. I was wondering if you could also share to us how your passion for this line of work was ignited.
Thank you, Ingrid, for that question. So, you know, I mentioned that I was an immigrant. I came with my parents to the United States when I was 2 years old. We first were in Kansas City. And then most of my formative years were spent in Montgomery, Alabama. So that's my hometown. We moved there because my parents, who are both doctors, got permanent jobs. And in fact, my dad helped to open a neonatal intensive care unit in Montgomery. And this is taking care of premature babies. And so while we had a happy childhood, there were multiple times in my childhood where I was otherized, where I was really told by my teachers, essentially, that I didn't belong. I'll give you two quick examples. One was in eighth grade in an earth science class where the teacher had us play Jeopardy. And after I was getting a number of questions right, another student asked out loud, you know, why is Manju getting all the answers? And the teacher's response to the whole class, and let me say I was the only non-white student in the class, he said, it's because she's not American. And so while I laughed it off in the moment, you know, sharing with my South Asian friends later, well, you know, if being American means being an idiot, count me out, right? That was, I'm sure, a protective device for me to handle what was happening. It was obviously really hurtful. Fast forward to 11th grade in my AP American History class, had a lot of friends in that class. This actually came from my very favorite teacher, who wrote me a number of recommendations for college that helped me get into, you know, the schools that I applied. But she asked a question in class really to justify the Japanese incarceration. And that question was, if the U.S. were at war with India, should we intern Manju and another student? And 24 out of the 25 students voted to intern me. So again, a number of these folks were my friends. This teacher really liked me, right? So even not only was she my favorite, but I think I was one of her favorite students. And yet this happened. The only student who voted against me was my African-American friend, Wanda, whom I continue to be friends with now. And so that was really a lesson in how hate works, how prejudice, discrimination, that here are some really smart students 2 years away from voting. And even though they know me, they are willing to do harm, not only to me, but to my community. And so it was really a wake-up call in terms of how the Japanese American incarceration worked and really what could happen again. And so it was these type of events that really, I think, moved me to work in the arena of racial justice. And I did exactly that. So I worked at the Southern Poverty Law Center after college, then at the ACLU in MALDEF, where I worked not only on behalf of our communities, that is Asian American and Pacific Islander, but also African American, Latinx, and it continues to be a passion of mine now.
I wanted to see if I could jump in, Coco, really quick and say how, I was going to say moved, but I think it's more of a visceral negative reaction to what you had shared. I just feel like when these circumstances happen, they happen so quickly and last so long. And I think what you're talking about with like white supremacist culture, that emotion is still being non-valued and still a fight towards saying like, this is what the lasting impact could look like. I'm sure Coco could expand on how I'm trying to like figure out how to heal from this. And so I really appreciate you being on this podcast because I think that for me, a lot of what I've been seeing at the Center for Inclusive Excellence or SDSU has been like education. But what I really appreciate about Epiphany and what you've brought into this space, Manju, is the healing part of it too, and also the policy. I feel like that's something that I've been curious about and how we connect all of that together. And I'm getting a better idea about how this is really like all spheres of how we can address and undo this.
Absolutely. And thank you for raising that question, Jessica, because it's so important. And yes, as a former civil rights attorney, policy is so critical to what we're trying to do and just to me personally. But I think, you know, people can't just wait for policy change, right? They are hurting right now. And it can be small things because often policy addresses the big systemic problems, right? Like discrimination. I know a lot of people believe in hate crimes prosecution. We tend to take a non-carceral approach to our work. But putting that aside, every single day, people are experiencing pain as a result of othering, as a result of not belonging. And, you know, what's been so important to me is to understand the mental health impacts and even the physical impacts. There's a wonderful book called Weathering by Arlene Geronimo, another about, you know, the body keeps the score. And so we know that, in fact, this does affect us each and every day. Often, you know, having immigrant parents, you know, we've been told, put your head down and just do your work. And even our parents or grandparents may say, oh, I didn't experience racism. And, you know, one, they may not be able to name and identify it. And two, they didn't have the space to talk about it because they were just trying to put food on the table. But something I'm really proud of in our Stop the AAPI Hate work and the work of AAPI Equity Alliance, one is in 2021, we partnered with Dr. Annie Saw, who was, I believe at that time, president or vice president of the Asian American Psychological Association. And she did a report with us surveying our respondents, found that 28% experienced some form of racial trauma as a result of experiencing a hate incident. that over 70% said anti-Asian hate was their biggest concern. This was before we even had a vaccine. So just imagine that this was front and center over even COVID-19. And third was that 23% actually experienced a reduction in symptoms simply from reporting to us. So that was, I think, such a surprise and a pleasant one at that. So at API Equity Alliance, many of our member organizations do mental health work and have been doing it for decades. So when California created Stop the Hate, we applied for a grant. And what we're doing with that grant is examining the impacts of hate on the mental health of five communities. And these are essentially the five largest communities that report to Stop API Hate. So that's Chinese, Korean, Filipino, Vietnamese, and Japanese. And we have essentially organizations that represent all of those communities. We don't have a Vietnamese specific organization, but we have one that works in the Southeast Asian community, primarily with Cambodians and some Vietnamese. But what we've done with that project is focus groups to see what those mental health impacts are. Dr. Annie Saw is actually leading that work substantively. And now we're about to launch into support groups. And so with those support groups, we are going to see if we can, using linguistically and culturally specific curriculum, address what our community members feel. Because it's not just for them individually, there is vicarious trauma. And we have learned from Black scholars that that is there, that when you live in a white supremacist society, you will in fact experience vicarious racism and vicarious trauma. So these are some of the pieces we're trying to uncover and address because, you know, at a basic level, hurt people. And so we are trying to engage in the healing process for all of our communities, right? Because white supremacy damages you at a mental health level, and can damage your physical health. And we want to put a halt to that.
I know this isn't really part of the podcast, Manju, but we would love to have you come back, come to San Diego State and present again. I mean, there's so many incredible points and topics that you've raised. The statistics are important. And just even sharing your personal narratives and experiences, I just find is so just helpful for us to hear. So we would love to have you back. And I know the listeners can't see us, but we're all just nodding our heads as you're talking. Like, there's just so much there that I think is affirming and sadly validating as you shared your personal experiences. It's so painful and hurtful to hear, but at the same time, it almost feels, in a way, like you can relate, because a lot of us have had, you know, experiences of being microaggressed or, you know, making comments of being othered, and it's very painful and isolating. And so I think in having this platform to be able to express that is very healing, because you don't feel like you're crazy or you don't feel like you're the only person that's gone through it. And so I also appreciate you touching upon the mental health aspect, because for me as a clinical psychologist that identifies as Asian American, it's always been a challenge, right? I think for me, growing up in a culture where we're taught to just endure and save face and not bring shame or burden others, going through something like this and having these hate crimes occurring to our community, it's very painful. And so I'm just so grateful that you're doing this work and finding ways, and shout out to Dr. Annie Saul too for the work that she's doing. And all of y'all that you're doing, because it's really important. And I was starting to get worried with just the way of everything going post-COVID and post-pandemic. It felt like at one point there was a lot of energy and attention being focused on what y'all were doing. And now it's kind of faded into, you know, there's a lot of other things going on in the world, but this work is still very, very important. So I'm really glad that you continue to push and do this work. I just had a question that I was curious about in all this work that you've done and continue to do. And I find that many of our students who are also passionate about, you know, social justice and the work that you do, how is it that you sustain yourself day in and day out going through this work and seeing these reports and having maybe vicarious trauma or triggers that come up from your experiences? And I imagine the policy work in the world is not very easy either. How do you sustain yourself? How do you continue to do this work? How do you know when to take breaks? How do you know when to jump back in?
Well, thank you, Coco, for that question. First and foremost, it is the appreciation and gratitude to the 11,000 plus individuals who have reported to us, who've taken the time, the energy. They didn't have to do this. And like I said, they're not necessarily getting resources, services out of it. So it's just really out of the goodness of their hearts. And in fact, you know, when Anisaw did that survey in 2021, people said that their main driver for reporting is to help solve this problem, to be part of a movement to address what's happening to our community. So, you know, you're the expert on mental health, but my understanding is, you know, when you have gratitude, you can express that gratitude. It helps with your everyday stress and anxiety to know how fortunate we are, and really that we are actually all part of this movement. And so it's not simply the 11,000. In 2021, after the Atlanta shootings, we saw people out in the streets. We saw ummas and appas, nannies and nanas, people who, you know, were not able to speak English, who were in wheelchairs and walkers, come out in full force and say, "We too are American. This is our country. And this is unacceptable." And so it's knowing that all of us are in this fight that keeps me going. I want to shout out, you know, do a shout out to our wonderful team at Stop AAPI Hate and AAPI Equity Alliance. I am just so lucky to work with some of the best individuals I've ever had a chance to know. Really dedicated, really thoughtful, and extremely hardworking, because they too know and feel what's happening. And even I will share with you, we have just issued 2 days ago a new report called Shades of Hate, and transformed our taxonomy, how we code the reports to us. And so we're not simply now able to report on the most explicit types of prejudice and racism, but also that which is coded or perceived. And again, there may not be policy solutions, but people are feeling the hurt. They're feeling the mental health impact. And I will tell you, in that coding process, members of our team felt the pain and the agony from reading all of the stories. And so what we decided to do there too was to provide mental health supports to our staff, because they were feeling it in their bodies. And so I just want to say again how appreciative I am, how grateful to be in this space with wonderful staff, with amazing community members. And, you know, at the end of the day, I have my family, I have my friends who have been there. They're my support system. And, you know, they, whether it's just bringing me coffee in the morning or ensuring, you know, that I'm well fed among podcasts and webinars, they do that for me. And so I just have tremendous gratitude in this work.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, hearing that. So on to the next question. I'm going to go a little bit off the script, but essentially, in an effort to better understand how Stop AAPI Hate enacts public policy change, can you give us an idea of how their work with different parts of the government, for example, federal, local executive, Congress, etc., what are some of the main or upcoming topics that Stop AAPI Hate is focused on right now?
Wonderful question, Yumi. So I will take you through how we have done this work. And I want to say here that all of our policy work is data informed and data driven. So we don't just do this work based on a hunch or like, oh, somebody had this idea. It actually comes from all of those reports. So when we started down the path of devising and developing bills in the California legislature, our team spent 3 months reading the reports and essentially looking for patterns and trends and ways in which the experiences that people in our community had could essentially be prevented, right, from happening again. So our policy team and advocacy team looked at those and they developed essentially a policy platform. And that included three things. One was civil rights, looking at ways in which discrimination happens in retail or public accommodations. Number two was public transit, because so much of what our community members have experienced is sadly at, you know, subway stations, on the bus, even just waiting for a bus. And then the last piece is the harassment, and especially the gender-based harassment that women in our community have experienced. And so what we did is we had three bills in the California legislature on all of those three topics. Two of them, so we, with public, you know, harassment, we wanted to really look at it in terms of gender-based violence and also as a public health issue, right? Because this does impact women day in and day out. It's not always racialized, but for Asian American women, Latinx, and Black women, it is often racialized and sexualized. Number two was the civil rights piece, and number three, public transit. Those two bills moved forward. They passed the legislature and were signed by the governor. So that has now created a change in policy in those two arenas. We came back this past year with a second bill on public transit. That too was signed by the governor. So really working with, you know, the Civil Rights Department in California to address discrimination in retail, and working with the public transit agencies to know and understand how can we make it safer to be in a subway station or at a bus stop, right? Could we have better lighting, more personnel? It's not always about law enforcement. At the federal level, we have been working closely with CAPAC, which is a Congressional Asian Pacific American Caucus, on a number of measures. One right now actually is in the essentially defensive posture, which is to prevent the passage or reauthorization of FISA, which is FISA is a process in which the government essentially surveils community members. And right now, and what happened after 9/11 is Congress passed a law and the president signed it to allow warrantless searches and surveillance of community members, of citizens, of US citizens. Okay, so that can happen right now. So what a bipartisan group of Congress folks have said is that's not okay to just surveil US citizens without a warrant. And we're saying as 60 Asian American organizations, that's not okay. And so we are opposing any such measures. We're working with Senator Ron Wyden, with folks in CAPAC and other caucuses to put a halt to this and say we need modifications, because we know warrantless surveillance and profiling has been used after 9/11 against South Asians, Sikhs, and Muslims. We know that Chinese researchers and scientists have lost their jobs, all of their livelihood, simply because of their race. They have been targeted, and with little to no evidence, accused of essentially spying for the Chinese government. So we need to fight these things, which are just by association, right? Guilt by association because of our racial or ethnic backgrounds. So those are just two of the measures, or two of the efforts, I should say, that we're engaged in. There are many, many more. I mentioned before Florida. We are now fighting in multiple states, similar laws coming to fruition. And the scapegoating has continued, will continue. Again, why we need each and every person in that fight. Just because we live in California, we're not immune. There was a bill that would prevent Chinese from purchasing land for agricultural uses in California. So some of that same racism is here in our home state.
Well, thank you very much for your response. That was very insightful.
I agree. I am just processing the enormity of where I'm thinking, like, just where to start and how to think about this. Thank you for giving us so much of your knowledge, education, and I feel like I'm a more informed citizen as a result. So I'm so excited for our listeners to be able to listen to this and really gain more insight. And like you said, to further contribute to this movement. And I just want to give an opportunity to the rest of the team as well, if you have any concluding thoughts as we are finishing our time together today.
I just want to say thank you so much again, Manju. This has been so informative. And I would really love to get some of the resources that you listed. You named some books, some studies, some websites. We would love to provide that to our listeners and our community. So thank you again. And thank you for inspiring us to continue this work. So we really appreciate it.
Well, thank you all for inviting me. Again, it was such an honor and privilege. And, you know, I want to just encourage listeners, if you're within a university or college system, please, please, please take Asian American studies classes, ethnic studies classes. That's how we raise awareness. That's also how we raise political power. Right? Because once you know about our history, you can connect the dots to your own experiences and you can then take action, right? I think too often we are not told our full history. And so we think that, you know, things are good. And when we do experience racism and hate, what happens is we feel isolated because we say, oh, America is a land of liberty and freedom and equality. So it must just be me. I must just be the one at fault. And so when you connect the dots, you see, no. It's not just you. It's other people who look like you, who come from the same backgrounds or same home countries. Number two, please engage with DEI efforts. And let's make sure that there are policies and protocols. So when discrimination happens, when racism takes hold, that there are institutions and processes we can go to get redress, to address our grievances, because institutions have to be held accountable. And I want to just say lastly, we are at a time right now that's actually quite scary. So our sisters and brothers who are Muslim, who are Western Asian, are experiencing something very similar to the backlash of 9/11. And so anti-Asian hate is not simply about those who are East Asian, or Southeast Asian and have a particular phenotype. It's against people like me, people who look like me, people who look and are Palestinian American, who are Pakistani American. We see too on college campuses, there's a real effort now to prohibit free speech, and that to silence students, especially students of color. And so it is really important now too that we connect the dots between our experiences and the experiences of other students who may not look like us, whose experience may be a little different. But we also know we have, and Stop AAPI Hate has issued a statement, AAPI Equity Alliance has issued a statement, we've experienced settler colonialism. We have experienced imperialism, right? Whether you're from the Pacific Islands and have experienced that from America, we've experienced war and genocide, right? If you're in Southeast Asia, I can say in India, we have seen, right, the partition was one of the worst things that happened and came out of British rule for over 200 years. So let's continue to connect the dots and let's speak out not only against the racism and hate we're experiencing, but that of sisters and brothers in other communities, other parts of Asia, but also African American, Latinx, our sisters and brothers in the LGBTQ movement and in Indigenous communities, because it's only when we work together, when we fight together, that we'll win.
Thank you so much, Manju. I am very inspired. This is definitely something that is reinvigorating me. Coco asked such a great question of like, how do you rejuvenate yourself? You know, this work is not easy and oftentimes very, like you mentioned, Manju, draining and heavy. But I'm just so honored that you joined us in this podcast and we had this moment with you. It's giving me just more perspective, and also very grateful for you, your team, everybody who's putting so much creativity, innovation, justice to our communities. And I feel that love. I feel like we don't always get to experience that. So for this hour, I feel just like so precious, and it's definitely going to radiate out for me. So thank you.
Thank you all for what you're doing, and would be an honor and privilege to continue to collaborate with all of you in the future.
Scene.